Last week we got to verse 9 of 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and I had a few more comments to say on verse 9 before we get to verse 10. Verse 9 is such a beautiful verse, so meaningful. "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that through his poverty you might be rich." What a beautiful, beautiful verse. It reminds us of what Paul said in Philippians chapter 2, which we all recall. "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but emptied himself, made himself of no reputation." That reminds us of this verse too, where Christ had the infinite riches, and yet he turned away from that for our sake and became poor. Though he was rich, I think means that Christ, he did not exploit that status for his own advantage, but he relinquished that status to help others, to serve others. Some people look at this and say, well, that's talking about Christ's life in an economic sense, that he became poor economically. Well, one, we don't know that Jesus was literally impoverished. He very likely was not. He was a carpenter. He had a family of tradespeople, and he was probably no worse off economically than others at the time that were in a similar situation under the Roman rule at that time. And to be consistent, if we're talking there about Christ's economic poverty, then shouldn't we then assume that the riches are also economic? And we know that's not the case. Certainly look at the Macedonians that Paul's talking about here. We know that they were impoverished and poor. So I think, of course, we're talking here about spiritual things, spiritual impoverishment and spiritual riches. I think the emptying himself, I think that's referring to his death, most likely. Certainly the incarnation in coming down in the form of a man, as a man. But he also, of course, made us rich through whatever the impoverishment that is being talked about here. And it's through his death, his voluntary death on the cross, that we did obtain all of those great spiritual riches. One commentator wrote, "Christ renounced the divine fullness of power in which he dwelt with the Father, abandoned the heavenly glory which was his as the Son of God. He chose the poverty of human existence so that through his poverty he could impart the eternal riches of redemption to the poverty of all for whose sake he became poor." I think another also expresses it very well. He writes, "Christ was made poor that we through his poverty might be rich. He took the form of a servant that we might regain liberty. He descended that we might be exalted. He was tempted that we might overcome. He was despised that he might fill us with glory. He died that we might be saved. He ascended to draw to himself those lying prostrate on the ground through sin's stumbling block." Just a beautiful, beautiful verse talking about all that Christ did for us. And it lands right here in this chapter on giving, where Paul is talking about giving to this fund to help the poor Christians in Jerusalem. And you know, this principle of interchange, he became poor so that we become rich. That's what we saw in chapter 5, verse 21. "For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him." Again, we have that interchange. I think that's the same concept that Paul is talking about here. Christ's sacrifice then becomes the real motive for giving, not trying to copy someone else or outdo the Macedonians or something. I mean, it's Christ sacrificed for us. That's the motive for giving. And Paul asked them to respond to what Christ has done for them. And it's, again, looking back at chapter 5, verse 15. "He died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died and was raised again." Just a beautiful verse. This self-emptying of Christ for Christians, of course, should lead others to empty their pocketbooks. I mean, it should lead us to think, well, now what can we do to help others? I think that's certainly why one reason Paul was talking about that here. Paul certainly followed Christ's example in his own life as he emptied himself for others, as he became poor, as he bore great hardships for others. And yet, Paul is not asking the Corinthians to give as Christ has given to them. He's not even asking them to give of their lives to others as Paul has, really. He's asking them not even to give out of their impoverishment as the Macedonians have given. He's asking them just to give their fair share, is really what Paul's asking as you read this, a proportion of what they have, to set aside a part each week and set it aside for this fund. But he reminds them here that Christ did not give his fair share. He gave so much more, so much more. His gift was way out of proportion. There was no guarantee that there would be this flood of gratitude from mankind back to God for that inexpressible gift. And of course, outside the church, there's not a flood of gratitude back to God for that inexpressible gift that he gave. That unmerited grace of God through the gift of his Son, I mean, that should inspire the Corinthians to give and be gracious to those who are in need. One more commentator, let me read you what he wrote. The drama of redemption took place where we live, in history, in Jesus of Nazareth. Therefore, let us express it where we live, says Paul, in the circumstances of each day's life. For example, in the sharing of one's purse to those who are in need. We can talk all day long about the great theological ramifications of Christ's sacrifice and on and on and on. But, you know, let's look at the checkbook. Let's look and see when the rubber meets the road, what do we do to show that grace of God in our lives when we see other people in need? From the example of the Macedonians and the example of Christ that Paul just gave, we can learn three important things about giving. True giving requires giving of oneself, not just giving money. The gospel is not about what we can get from God, but about what God has given to us and how that is expressed in our lives. Second, you can give out of extreme poverty, as the Macedonians did, as the widow did with the widow's mite. You can also give out of measureless riches that you may have. And you can give either way. But those who are disinclined to be generous when they're poor are not likely to suddenly become generous when they become rich. Generosity is something that tends to transcend whether you have a lot or don't have very much. Generosity in many cases is independent of that. If you're generous when you're poor, you will be so when you're rich. If you're not generous when you're poor, you probably will not be after you win the lottery. Third, giving is related to the grace of God experienced in Christ. The recipients are not required to have done anything to merit the gift except to be in need. And you know that it's not that the law or the Jerusalem congregation, are they worthy of our gift? No. They are in need of that gift. And that should be what we look for to see if they are in need and if we can help them. Fortunately, God did not look down at us and say, are these people worthy of having my Son? No. It was unmerited grace of God that he came down and gave that inexpressible gift to us. Verse 10. And herein I give my advice, for this is expedient for you who have begun before, not only to do, but also to be forward a year ago. Paul doesn't command them on this matter, but he does give them some very authoritative counsel. Paul wants to motivate them through reasoning, because he knows genuine benevolence for others is not something that really can be commanded. You know, I command you to be filled with grace. I command you to be... No, it's not something that can be commanded someone. So Paul is talking to them, trying to reason with them, and giving them a basis for why they should be that way. He doesn't want to seem to criticize them. And we're going to see that as we go through this. His relation with the Corinthians has been strained since the first letter. We talked about that some last week. He does, though, want to tell them what he thinks is best. Their original intention was good, but if they don't carry it out, it's going to make them look very bad. That's kind of the gist of what Paul is telling them here. The phrase translated a year ago, that doesn't necessarily mean one full calendar year ago. Like if it's now December, then a year ago is last December. It just means sometime in the last calendar year. It could be as little as a month ago. That's what the idiom meant at that time. But we know a lot has happened in the meantime, so it probably is many months ago that occurred. And Paul, I think, is showing, in a sense, his leadership style here, because he's praising what can be praised. He's starting off with a note of praise here. And he's talking about their willingness to commit in the first place. They started off very good, but something has happened along the way. I think, though, he's very subtly communicating the message, talk is cheap. If you're going to really carry on with this, you need to carry on with it and finish what you started. Now is the time to produce. Paul thinks it's in their best interest to complete what they were willing to start. Well, why? Well, they've already started. They shouldn't leave something undone. He's going to talk to them about that. Nothing is accomplished if what they started is not finished. I mean, they may have had a grand intention, but that's going to lead nowhere if they don't actually carry through and finish it. So, of course, he has that message for them here also. Also, they really get no credit, in a sense, for their initial enthusiasm if it disintegrates before the task is finished. It's not going to help the Jerusalem saints at all if all they have is this grand plan to send them money, but it never actually materializes. You know, there's a really important lesson for us here in this chapter. In addition to the beautiful lesson on giving, there's the lesson that we need to finish what we start. One small task, if completed, it may be worth more than 100 grand plans that were never finished. Or worse, maybe even never even started. We need to finish what we start. And that's a lesson for churches all across the land. As we have plans and things that we're planning on doing, we need to have the plan. We need to enact the plan. We need to finish the plan and get through and then have another plan. Jesus talked about that in Luke 14, where he talked about someone intending to build a tower, but not being able to finish it. So that's another important lesson here, in addition to the lesson I'm giving, is finish what we start. And verse 11 starts off with a wonderful expression of that. Now, therefore, perform the doing of it. I mean, that's a great phrase. Perform the doing of it, Paul says. That as there was a readiness to will, so there may be a performance also of that which ye have. For if there be first a willing mind, it is accepted according to that a man hath, and not according to what he hath not. The only imperative command in this chapter appears in verse 11 and strikes at the heart of Paul's concern that they finish what they started. Paul's not trying to recruit them here at the last minute. They were first to get involved. They've been involved with this for a long time. He's trying to get them to reverse their last minute foot dragging. Putting off something not only results in this dwindling motivation where it just kind of finally grounds to a halt and disappears, but it really calls into question their initial willingness. Were they really that willing and that interested initially to help the Jerusalem saints? If now I can't even get them to follow through, it really calls that into question. The phrase translated according to your means there, literally out of what you have, that parallels the phrase in verse 3 of chapter 8, according to their ability. Paul did not ask them to do as the Macedonians did and go beyond their means, but he asked them to give according to their means. They are not to go into debt, not to become disadvantaged or overburdened. Paul's goal is not unreasonable here. He's not trying to raise record amounts. We talked before about his real goal here, and that is to show the Jerusalem saints that there is solidarity, there's unity between the Jerusalem congregation and the Gentile congregations. And Paul wanted to raise this money and enact this plan to do that. In fact, back in chapter 16 of 1 Corinthians, you recall, Paul just told them, set aside a sum each week and have it there and collect it. And he's not telling them to impoverish themselves with this collection. It's not unreasonable at all. But whatever they give, they're to give generously. And, of course, he ensures them then that is acceptable to God. It's more of the attitude. God does not expect the widow's mite from all of us. I don't think he certainly did not require the widow's mite from the widow. That was all that she had to live on. But that is what she gave. And it showed her generosity and her spirit. God expects us to give generously and to give based upon what we've been given. What matters is our heart, how we give. Once that's right, the gift will follow. The gift will follow. Corinth was a very wealthy congregation. We've talked about that before. The Macedonian congregations were much worse off than Corinth. In fact, Corinth, we know, had some members that were very well off. And we've talked about them all the way back in the first letter. Paul doesn't mention anything about the Corinthians' poverty here like he did the Macedonians. So I think we can assume they were not in the same dire financial straits that the Macedonians were in. So why then does Paul share this piece of wisdom about giving according to your means, one commentator had a very intriguing suggestion on that. He said, well, that may be directed to the poor who were in Corinth. And we've also met them before. Remember back in the first letter that they were being belittled by the others, that they didn't have enough and they didn't have enough to eat, and that people were eating and gorging themselves in front of these poor Christians. Remember all of that back in the first letter? Those people are still there. And I think Paul may be directing some of this toward them, who may have been slighted and humiliated by others because they weren't giving very much. Look at that guy, that slave. He only gave 2 mites. I gave all this gold. I mean, who knows what they were hearing. Barclay has a very interesting point here about the slaves in Corinth, because there were slaves in Corinth, slaves who were members of that congregation. If they were giving anything to this fund, of course, it could only have been a very small, a token amount. But you know what? If they had any savings at all, do you know what they were saving for? As a slave, they would have been saving for their own freedom, to set themselves free, to buy their freedom. And they were giving out of that fund to help saints in Jerusalem that they never met and never would meet. Talk about a generous giving attitude, a spirit of giving. And then you had the rich there in Corinth who may have been begrudgingly giving anything, while slaves were giving money that they were saving for their very own personal freedom. Paul, though, is not asking here for such a bold sacrifice. He's just asking for proportionate giving. Give out of what your means. Give out of how you've been blessed. Verses 13 through 15. For I mean not that other men be eased and ye be burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that had gathered little had no lack. You know, stinginess has a way of expressing itself in several ways, one of which is through suspicion of others and their motives. Why are they after my money? And another is through rationalization of its own tight-fistedness. Well, I'm not going to give it because they're not, you know, I've got some rationalization for not giving. And Paul, I think, is aware here that there was probably some griping going on in Corinth. Well, you know, others are going to be profiting from our hard-earned money. We have to bear the burden while this Jerusalem congregation gets rich off of us. We have enough financial troubles of our own. Why should we help others? People we don't even know. I mean, I'm sure Paul could either got wind of some of that through people who'd reported it to him, or he knew them well enough to know some of that was going on. And Paul here is being realistic. Unless one has the Spirit of Christ, one does not want to bear a greater burden that someone else might be relieved. That's just not human nature. So he's trying to deflect, and I think these complaints and this griping that's going on. And he's trying to let them know, you know, the Jerusalem congregation, they're not going to live the high life on your gift when you give this gift to them. They're not going to start throwing parties and suddenly they're going to be the... No, that's not what's going to go on at all. Paul does not ask the Corinthians to give more than others, because, you know, they're better off. He's asking them to give what they can. The example of the Macedonians, I think, shows Paul's not placing an unequal burden on them. He doesn't want them to become hard-pressed in offering relief to others. The word hard-pressed there, it's the same word in verse 2 of chapter 8, refers to the Macedonians' test of affliction. The Corinthians giving to this fund, even sacrificially, will hardly compare with the severe affliction the Macedonians have endured. I think the principle undergirding this whole project is equality, or equity, as some of the translations have there. The word there in verse 14 could mean justice or fairness. Paul does not write so that there might be equity, as I think the New International Version translates that. But he instead writes out of equity. Paul's not talking about the purpose of their giving to create equality. He's talking about the ground, the reason for the giving, from equality. I think in Romans 15, verses 25 through 31, where Paul also talks about this Jerusalem project, he there talks about a debt, but it was not a material debt. It was a spiritual debt that the Gentile congregations owed the congregation there in Jerusalem. And this then is a way of paying off that spiritual debt. We've talked before about how the Corinthians were very keen on all the social conventions at the time. And Paul was trying to make sure he didn't ruffle any more feathers in Corinth. I think he'd already ruffled a few feathers. He was trying to avoid that again. And you can see him at work here as he's working through these social sensitivities of the Corinthians. And he shows that here when he talks about this future reciprocity. The protocol of gift-giving in this culture took for granted that when there was a disparity in the exchange of gifts, that the one who outgave the other attained a greater status over the other. And the one that was outgiven went down the social ladder a bit. So it was this give and take, and they maintained, by looking at the size of the gift, where you were on this social ladder. And Paul, I think, is looking at that attitude here. And he's saying that the Corinthians' plenty will now supply the needs of the saints, so that in turn their plenty, he says, will supply what you need. No one will outgive the other that way and attain some higher status. There's going to be this reciprocity. Now, Paul's statement, though, leaves open the possibility that they will repay in kind with material gifts, perhaps. You know, maybe if the Corinthians ever fall into hard times, which could happen. We've already talked about famine. We know there was famine in the area. We talked about that in the first letter. There was a lot of persecution. May not have been as intense in Corinth at this time, but it could spread all very quickly, as we know from the history of the church, and particularly of the Romans. There could come a time when, in fact, the material blessings would be flowing the other way. But in chapter 9, we're going to see next week, Paul is going to give a twist to this convention of gift-giving and this social reciprocity, because Paul is going to say that God is generous with those who are generous with the poor. I think he changes entirely the dynamics of gift-giving as he moves into chapter 9, and we'll see that. Because the relationship, instead of just being a line between the giver and the one who gets the gift, suddenly becomes triangular as God moves into the picture. So he changes entirely the dynamics of gift-giving, as now the Corinthians are giving to people who they have never met, may never meet, and they may never receive anything from them. But God is in the picture. And that's, I think, kind of the missing element that Paul is stressing here, as Paul kind of weaves his way through this maze of cultural expectations and various things that the Corinthians were stressing. The quotation there is from Exodus 16, verse 18, about manna. And that kind of caps Paul's argument here. Manna was distributed each according to his need, and Paul takes that as a divine pattern. Now, some commentators say, well, this quotation really isn't relevant at all here. It really doesn't talk about give and take, which is what Paul was talking about. But, of course, it is relevant. It's directly relevant to what Paul was talking about, and that is that the one of equality. That was the basis of the giving. And Paul interprets this passage to apply to this equality of sharing, the trying to amass more than you need, and hoarding it when you see other people in need, that all you're going to end up with is rot, because that's what they ended up with this manna. And I think Paul is using that as the lesson here. The enough, of course, there has to do with what's necessary. Unfortunately, the continuation of the story of the manna tells us that humans never really have enough. And they never think they have enough. We're never satisfied with just one omer apiece. We always want to squirrel away more than that for ourselves. And we grow dissatisfied with the manna from heaven, and we want other things. And that also happened in the wilderness. But this anxiety over possessing and hoarding and keeping, that's throttling the generosity that they might have had for others. And it's that selfishness and that covetousness, I think, that Paul is addressing here. You know, there's a verse in 1 Timothy chapter 6 that, you know, if there's one verse, one short verse that speaks to our time, you know, one verse that would go so far to solve so many problems, it's 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Godliness and contentment. You know, I in another class, I think it was the one on Ecclesiastes, which these are all on the web, I talked about our society. Think about television, all the impact that television has on society and how it's changed society. What are the two things that television attacks most? Contentment and godliness. Contentment and godliness. You've got the horrible filth that comes out, of course, we know, attacking godliness. But then you've got all the commercialization, all the contentment. Contentment and godliness. And with those two things is great gain, Paul writes in 1 Timothy. And then he continues on in verse 7 of 1 Timothy 6. For we brought nothing into this world, it is certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. I think that's the same message that Paul is addressing very subtly here with the Corinthians. This divine principle, no one has a surplus, no one has a shortage, was enforced by God in the time of the wilderness wanderings. Now it's voluntary, dependent on the working of God's grace in the lives of the Christians. You know, Paul talks so much in his letters about money and the handling of money. He told the Corinthians earlier they should not depend on their money, but they should live independently of it in 1 Corinthians 7. He warns others to be aware of greed in Romans, in 1 Corinthians, in Ephesians, in 1 Timothy. Provide for those in need, he writes in a number of his letters. In Ephesians 4:28, he tells us why we work, so that we have something to share with those in need, he writes in Ephesians 4:28. And on the other side, though, he warns people in 2 Thessalonians not to take advantage of others' generosity. So Paul is looking at both sides of this. But he writes over and over how we need to be generous and to help and to look for those in need. You know, Paul sees this project, as we talked about earlier, as an outworking of a greater divine principle than just helping the poor. It's creating this worldwide fellowship of Christians. You know, we can get on the phone now and call Christians all over the world. They didn't have that then. And there was, in that sense, there was there could be a lot more division, because they had the Jewish Christian meeting in Jerusalem and the Gentile congregations over here. You know, it was just like two ships passing in the night. And Paul was trying to make sure that they were united. And this gift was going to do that. And over and over again, I think we need to remember he has that in mind, a much bigger purpose in mind than just the money. God has poured out his grace on Christians, and on these Christians particularly. And that should cause them to be generous to others. Verses 16 through 17. In these two verses, Paul informs the Corinthians about the envoys that he sent to help them with the final arrangements. And here again we see Paul the detail person, where he's making sure it all works like clockwork. You know, in the legal profession, we tend to classify people as to the kind of the theme person, has the big themes. Then we have the detail people who get the big themes done, you know. And the big theme person often doesn't do the details. And the detail person, Paul was a big theme person, and he also got the details done. He got down and he made sure it happened. He sent the people. He made sure they were there. He made sure everything happened. And we see that working here as he now talks about the people who are going to come over there and help them do this. He talks about Titus, who we know. He talks about the brother famous among the churches for his ministry in the gospel, who we don't know, and another whom he has found earnest, someone else we don't know. Titus is mentioned in verses 16 through 17. The brother famous among the churches is mentioned in verse 18. And this third person, the brother found earnest, we'll see in verse 22. Only Titus is named. Now these three are going to reinforce his exhortations about the collection. But Paul is tiptoeing around issues here, because he does not want it to appear to the Corinthians that he's sending this strong-arm squad over there to get the money out of them. He wants to make sure that they know that he's still not trying to coerce them into giving. So he's going to explain why these people are coming and what they're doing and what their role is in this procedure. The Corinthians might be surprised to see Titus again so soon. He had seen him recently. So Paul is writing this commendatory explanation here about why Titus is coming. And in fact, he says he's coming of his own accord, Paul writes. And one commentator said that really speaks volumes, that Paul wrote down that Titus is coming because he wants to come. I'm not sending Titus over there. Paul is not sending some underling over there to take care of matters. Titus is coming because he wanted to come. He's interested in the Corinthians. He has the same zeal for this collection that Paul does. He has the same zeal for the project. That's why Titus is coming. As we move into verse 18, we meet this brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. And this renowned brother is being sent with Titus. Paul does not tell us who these churches might be. Conceivably, he's known everywhere in Paul's mission field. But it's more likely he's meaning the churches at least in that general area, perhaps Macedonia or Achaia. These churches sing his praises for what he's done for the gospel, literally in the gospel. Of course, one of the most important tasks in the gospel is proclaiming the gospel. And that phrase is clearly associated with preaching, the phrase in the gospel that's used here in Romans and 1 Corinthians and 1 Thessalonians. Paul associates it with preaching. So in fact, this person, this renowned brother, may have been a proclaimer of the gospel, a preacher of the gospel. And that may be what this phrase means. Since the early days of the church, the intriguing question has always been, who is this brother? Who is this unnamed person that Paul says here, who was famous at the time? You know, it's odd to recommend people without giving their names. And this has raised all sorts of speculation here. Paul generally omits the names of his adversaries. Not always, but generally. For instance, the offender in this letter, and we don't know who that person was, didn't tell us his name. But he generally does not omit the names of his supporters. But here, I think he does. He doesn't name these two. The simplest reason for the omission is probably the best, and that is that they all knew who he was. That they knew who this person was. He's famous, after all, right? So they must have known who he was. And he arrived with the letter, so it's unnecessary to name him. But that's not enough for us. We want to know who he is. So there's been a lot of candidates that have been mentioned. Luke, Barnabas, Timothy, Silas, Mark, Aristarchus, Apollos. You can read commentators that take the case for each of those people. Let's talk about Luke. Throughout Acts, Luke never mentions Titus. And in this epistle, Paul refers to Titus, but never to Luke. One commentator argued, interestingly, that in the first century, writers would refrain from identifying close relatives. I'm not sure what he based that on. But then he surmised that maybe Titus and Luke were close relatives, maybe possibly brothers. And if you look in Acts 20, verse 4, you'll find the list of travelers who went with Paul to Jerusalem. Yet you'll not find anyone there representing Corinth. Maybe Luke accompanied Paul from Philippi to Jerusalem. Remember, Luke was writing the book of Acts. Was Luke the brother who carried the Corinthian gift? Was Luke present with Paul when 2 Corinthians was written in Macedonia? You know, many Byzantine manuscripts. Time for the handout. Included an explanatory note at the end of the epistle that reads, and that's what we're looking here at the bottom, the second epistle to the Corinthians was written from Philippi through, and then the blow up is Titus and Luke. First word there is Titus, and the last word there doesn't look much like Luke, but you see that upside down triangle, or maybe right side up triangle, is the Greek letter lambda, L. So you can kind of make Luke out as you look at that. That's Titus and Luke. Now that's not inspired, of course. That's an explanatory note. But it goes back into some pretty early manuscripts, suggesting that maybe Titus and Luke were there when Paul wrote that. And maybe this renowned brother is Luke. And in fact, I will tell you that that is the most, I won't say the most likely, but it's certainly the most popular choice for who this renowned brother is. And Luke certainly fits the bill on being renowned at the time. Others have said Barnabas. You know, there's a big rift between Paul and Barnabas. Yet that seems to have gotten better. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 6, we see that perhaps that relationship had been restored. Timothy. We know that Paul had earlier sent Timothy over there to the Corinthian congregation. We talked about that before. At the beginning of this epistle, Paul identifies Timothy as our brother, which literally is the brother. That's the same title that's used here. Maybe Paul is just referring back to the brother that he mentioned at the beginning of the letter, Timothy. Also a possibility. Silas has been mentioned. Silas and Timothy certainly were together in Corinth. They were together. They went from Macedonia to help Paul preach in Corinth. Mark has been mentioned. Aristarchus has been mentioned. In a moment, we're going to see that some argue that this group included Macedonians, and some argue this group did not include Macedonians. If it did include Macedonians, then Aristarchus is a much more likely candidate because he was a Macedonian. Apollos. Some people say, well, this is Apollos. He was certainly a renowned preacher. He certainly was known in Corinth. We saw that in the first letter. Paul refers to him as our brother or the brother in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. He had tried to get Apollos to go to Corinth, as we recall, and Apollos had been unwilling. But Paul had later said in 1 Corinthians 16:12 that Apollos would come when he had an opportunity. Well, maybe this is that opportunity. Maybe this is Apollos. In my own mind, I would say either Luke, Timothy, or Apollos would be probably who this unnamed brother is in verse 18. Verses 19 through 20. Some commentators argue that this group included representatives from Macedonia, and others argue it did not. Those who argue it did point to verse 19 and say that the churches there must include the Macedonian congregations because those are the ones that Paul has been writing about. Those are the ones he explicitly referred to in verse 1 of chapter 8. He never gave any indication he was referring to another group. Those who argue it did not include Macedonians point to verse 4 of the next chapter, chapter 9, where Paul appears to treat the arrival of the Macedonian representatives as a hypothetical, suggesting that he didn't expect it to happen. But if it did happen, they didn't want to be embarrassed by what they were doing. Chapter 9 is the key there, which means it will be handled next week by my co-teacher. So I will leave that controversy for next week. There was some tension among the Christians about the Macedonians. We know that. Paul had declined to accept patronage from the Corinthians. Remember, he wouldn't accept support from the Corinthians. But as we're going to see in chapter 11, you know what? Paul accepted support from the Macedonians for his work in Corinth. Don't you know that upset some people in Corinth? These rich Corinthians probably didn't like the appearance of receiving aid from the poor Macedonians. And so that may have been behind some of these issues about who Paul was sending and who he was not sending. Why does Paul say this unnamed brother was chosen of the churches? Well, he was not chosen to help them complete their donations. I think he was chosen to represent whoever these churches were. He accompanied Titus, I think, to ensure the integrity of the project. He was almost like a third-party, impartial witness there to make sure everything was done according to the plan in a virtuous and an unimpeachable way. We know there were some people there who were casting all sorts of false accusations against the Apostle Paul. And no telling what kind of vicious rumors they were spreading about Paul and about this contribution. Oh, he's just going to line his own pockets. It'll never reach Jerusalem. We'll never hear about this. I mean, who knows what they were saying. So I think Paul is sending these other representatives, chosen not by him, but by others, to make sure everything is above board and beyond reproach. And you can see Paul's concern here. And isn't it a sad commentary that Paul is having to spend time on that because of all the vicious rumors that were going on there in the city of Corinth? But he does spend time on that because he wants to make sure that it is above reproach. When people are looking for any excuse in the world not to give, it's better not to give them an excuse. Just do everything above reproach and make sure that if they have some excuse, and they want one, they'll find one. But if they have one, let's not give it to them. Verse 21. Paul cites Proverbs 3, verse 4 there. He also cites that in Romans 12. Again, just to underscore his honorable intentions. His motives, his actions are an open book to God who scrutinizes him. Still, he wants to be completely open to the people. And he's also concerned about that. And there were people there trying to discredit him, unfortunately. And he's sensitive to those charges. Verse 22. And we have sent them with our brother, whom we have oftentimes proved diligent in many things. We have a third person. This is a third person going, accompanying Titus and accompanying the famous brother. He's identified here as our brother, which I think distinguishes him from the first one, who's identified as the brother. His position on the list and the fact that he was sent by Paul, I think, suggests he had lesser seniority than the others. One commentator writes, if we were able to guess at the identity of the brother in verse 18, we admit we had no idea who this brother may have been. So we just don't know who this was. This was someone working with Paul. But Paul had a very high opinion of him. He was diligent. That can mean active, zealous, earnest. The confidence in verse 22 could be Paul's confidence or it could be this brother's confidence. Either one. Some translations have it each way. If it's the brother's confidence, he could only have gotten that, though, through Paul and Paul's confidence in the Corinthians. Whoever this third brother was, he was an optimist. He was eager to get to work. What better qualifications could there be for anyone working in any endeavor? He didn't start off on his mission complaining, well, the Corinthians aren't going to give anyway. Why are we going over there? It's never going to work. We'll never get all the way to Jerusalem with this money. Our ship will sink. It's going to be stolen anyway along the way. They'll stop and they'll steal it. So what does it really matter? The Macedonians gave so little. How's that going to help? They're going to spend that on the first day. You know, I really don't have time. I'm busy. Eager to go. Excited about the trip. He wanted it to work. He was zealous. What better qualifications? I mean, that's what Paul describes this person. He was an optimist. Verses 23 and on. Paul rounds out this paragraph with a final reference to Titus and his brothers and the brothers and his qualifications. The most important qualification is they are identified as the glory of Christ. They bring glory to Christ by the quality of their lives. They are dedicated to the gospel and to the glory of Jesus Christ. The phrase could also mean they reflect the glory of Christ, as Paul is the aroma of Christ, we saw in chapter 2. Or the Corinthians are a letter of Christ, we saw in chapter 3. They are a credit to Christ. They are a glory to Christ. One commentator writes, "The glory of God is that which makes the invisible God visible, that which makes God known." And these people reflected that glory into the world as they made God known through their attitude and through their giving. They're more than just envoys. They've become a standard of Christian living. They're reflecting the glory of Christ. And in verse 24, Paul entreats the Corinthians to live up to his boasts about them, to these people. In verse 24, I think Paul reemphasizes the appeal in the earlier verses, to fulfill their commitment, to finish what they've started. They are to show the proof of their love to these men and to the churches. And I think this exhortation shows that the proof of their love is not simply receiving these emissaries with open arms, but contributing, doing what they said they were going to do, following through, showing their love to God through obedience to God and through following through. You know, one of the songs in our songbook has the memorable line, "Father, show me now that you love me." Yeah, we've sung that one. "Show me now that you love me? Yes, Father, I know you sent your only begotten Son into the world to die for me. But what have you done for me lately?" We should sing and pray that we will show God that we love Him. God has shown that He loves us. 1 John 4:7-12. "In this was manifested the love of God toward us, because that God sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him." God has shown that He loves us. It's time for us to show that we love God, to prove our love for God. How do we do that? By following His commands, by having in our lives the grace, the generosity that comes through Jesus Christ and through the grace that has been shown to us through that perfect sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. 1 John 5:3, "For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments." That's how we prove, that's how we show our love for God. Let's not ask God to show His love for us. He has done that. He has done that. And the Corinthians' generosity will be proof that God's grace is at work in them. And finally, Paul appeals to their pride to show their generosity. Every eye, so to speak, was on Corinth at this time. Christians and churches of Christ, we don't always make the right decisions. But accountability to others helps us do what is right and stay on the right path. And Paul assumes that Christians live and act out of this interest in how the other congregations act and how they will view what we do. We're answerable to each other in that sense. And Paul wanted to make sure that this church in Corinth, about which he thought so highly, about where he had toiled and worked so hard, did him proud, so to speak, and helped out and worked and did what they needed to do, particularly in light of what the Macedonians had done. Thank you for your attention. Next week, chapter 9.